Our guest today is Michael Barra, co-author of the fascinating and popular book, Dark Mission. Would you tell your audience about your background, please, Mike?
Yeah, I'm an aerospace engineer and engineering consultant. I've worked for a lot of major aerospace companies, both in the defense side of things and space and satellites and commercial airplanes. I also do a lot of what they call CAD consulting, computer-aided design consulting. It's basically software consulting for engineering-specific software packages. And beyond that, I've been doing research and writing articles for Richard Hoagland's Enterprise Mission website for the last 10 years now. So I'm Richard about 10 or 11 years. And I co-wrote this book, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, with him. It just came out back in October.
And how did you and Richard Hoagland meet? And what made you decide to get together to write the book? It's so controversial. That's why I'm asking that question, you know?
Well, how we met was really interesting. I had worked at a fairly large aerospace company in the Seattle area, which I think everybody can figure out. And at that time, I worked with a gal named Fran. And it turned out that later on, she was married to a gentleman named Ken Johnston, who met Richard in 1995 and gave him some Apollo imagery, some early generation prints that he had been storing for almost 30 years at that point, 25 years, I guess, at that point, and had started to sort of work with Richard. He was, attended a press conference with him in Washington, D.C. in 1996, and I was kind of in the early version of the Enterprise Mission website. I was in the bulletin board kind of debating the various issues of the day back and forth, and Ken said, "Hey, my wife thinks she knows you from the company. And are you the same guy?" And I said, "Yeah, I was the same guy." And he lived in Seattle, and so did I. And we got together a few times for dinner and some things like that. And then he introduced me to Richard. And I guess in 1998, when the first Mars Global Surveyor images of the face on Mars came out, I offered Richard an article. Do you want an article on image enhancement for your website? And he said, "Sure, write it up." So I wrote it up, and he liked it. And I wrote some more stuff for him, and he liked it. And pretty soon, we were working together, pretty closely on just about all the big stories and subjects that we were covering over the last 10 years.
Uh-huh.
So out of that came, a couple years ago, I guess back in 2002, I said, you haven't written a book in over 20 years, and it's probably time to put some of the stuff together in one concise format or one concise place in a single book, and so people can sort of piece this thing together in a real sequential linear way, because the biggest issue that I think you have with the internet is that when you give stuff away for free, people don't completely appreciate it is one problem, and the other thing I think is that people forget this thread that connects with that other thread. But if you put it together in one place and you show them the whole picture and the sequence of events, then I think it's easier for people to put together that these events are connected and see how a pattern develops. So that was the concept behind the book, and that's how it all got started. And it took a lot longer to write than I actually thought it would.
But, I see that. It's actually half
of the original amount of information we wanted to put in it. So there's more to come, I think.
Good. How and why did you get interested in the abnormalities on the Moon and Mars?
Well, that's also pretty interesting. I had heard about the face on Mars back in 1976. I remembered that from the newspaper articles at the time, and I remembered NASA's information or NASA's explanation that it was just a trick of light and shadow. And I've always been somebody who just didn't quite believe that we were getting the whole story. I remember as a young kid watching all Gemini and Apollo missions through space and just sort of not believing that we were getting the whole story and recognizing that, there were things that just didn't make sense to me. Like I specifically remember on Apollo 11, you know, I was saying to myself as I was watching Neil Armstrong walk on the moon, I kept saying to myself, you know, my family has color TV. Why are we only getting this really crappy, grainy, black and white picture? You know, and these things bothered me. And then later on, actually, that ended up in Dark Mission. That the story about that ended up in the.
I read it.
Oh, good. Okay.
No, I read the whole book.
yeah, I'm sure you did. You know, from that, in the early 90s, again, my brother had talked to me that he had heard some more recent stuff about the face on Mars, that they had done some more image analysis of it, and that it did start to look more and more like a face, and some of the NASA explanations didn't quite add up. And then I got transferred to a swing shift on my job at that large aerospace company in the Pacific Northwest. And I started driving home from midnight. You know, about midnight, I'd be done with my shift, and I'd drive home. And, of course, you know, Coast to Coast AM was just sort of coming on the air at that time, and Art Bell and Richard was a fairly frequent guest. And I didn't really know who this guy was, but I liked listening to him. And then another part of the story, which was really interesting, was that after Mars Observer disappeared in 1993, Richard had called a press conference and made some rather strong statements about NASA not being completely honest about what had happened to it and some weird things that had happened with that mission. And again, that's in the book, too. And I saw him on the McNeil Lehrer News Hour, which is a pretty prestigious news program, especially at that time. And I was really impressed with him. I was impressed with how smart he was, how he had an answer for everything, how careful he was not to, you know, go beyond, not to jump to conclusions. It seemed like he was a really rational, reasonable guy talking about a very, very bizarre subject. And he seemed to be taken very seriously. And then, you know, one night at work, I noticed I was walking, it was a lunch hour, and I was walking, I don't know, through the hallways, and I saw a bunch of my coworkers in a conference room, and I stuck my head in there, and they were all watching a video of his speech at the UN. So I was like, there's that same guy again, you know? And then eventually I realized that the guy on the radio was the same guy that was on the videotape, once I got the videotape. So that started me, you know, getting me fascinated. I think that the UN video was extremely impressive with the way that he put together his arguments, and I really was attracted to it because I thought to myself, this is something that can be proven. It's something that can be verified someday. It's not like UFOs and abductions and things like that, that I just don't think you're ever going to be able to really prove to everybody's satisfaction. But this, it seemed like, with better pictures, we'd be able to tell whether this stuff is artificial or not. At least from an engineer's perspective, it seemed to me that if we got good pictures, we'd be able to reach the conclusion. So that's why I was real attracted to his investigation, you know, over other, you know, UFO subjects and abductions and things like that,
right,
that were out in the news.
In the book, you discuss power struggles between different factions involved in space exploration and then in NASA after it was formed. You mentioned the fact that the former Nazis at NASA seemed to have a secret agenda, and that was to celebrate things like Hitler's birthday by performing memorable events on this day. How do you think that they got away with this without anyone noticing, or do you think that the powers that be just looked the other way? And if you remember, would you tell us about one of those events?
Sure. What you're talking about is, for instance, we've landed on the surface of the moon twice on Adolf Hitler's birthday, on April 20th. Once was in 1968, I think, or it might have been 67, but it was Surveyor 2, and it landed on the moon in Oceanus Procellarum, and later on Apollo 12 landed at that same sacred site as part of, I guess, an exercise. Part of it was an exercise to see if they could actually, you know, find Surveyor 2 and land at a very, very precise location. The other time was with Apollo 16. This was a manned mission this time, unlike the unmanned Surveyor probe. Apollo 16, the lunar module Orion, landed on the moon, again on Adolf Hitler's birthday, on April 20th. In fact, there were little delays in the landing cycle that actually made the clock slip over from, you know, April 19th to April 20th. And, you know, based on that stuff and a whole bunch of other information that's in the book, you know, we came to the conclusion that the Nazi faction within NASA, which was very extensive and very deep and very wide inside of NASA, had, we thought, obviously manipulated these events. So they picked this date for a reason. And in terms of how they got away with it, I think that, you know, the Masons, which is another organization, the Scottish Rite Freemasons, that was also operating in NASA at the same time, was essentially doing the same thing. They were picking dates and times that were related to more to landing in a certain place on the moon when the stars were in a certain position, honoring ancient Egyptian gods, which were the root gods of the Freemasonic belief system. And we pretty much tracked all that stuff down, and we documented it, I think, very extensively in the book, and we documented it even more so on the web in various articles. So I think what happened was is they didn't have to get away with it. I think everybody was doing this at NASA. I think each of these different factions, and we focus on primarily three of them, but the Freemasons and the Nazis and then the JPL crowd that we refer to as the magicians, they were all doing it. So I don't think that they were doing anything that was not okay with the other powers that be inside NASA. I think it was okay with the other guys that were in the know on some of the real reasons why we landed at a certain place at a certain time on the moon.
Your book states that Buzz Aldrin took a Masonic flag to the moon and brought it back, and it was presented to the head of his Masonic lodge. How did you find out about this, and do you think it was authorized by NASA?
Well, there's a couple things about that. It wasn't actually the head of his Masonic lodge. What he brought that flag back and presented it to the head of the Scottish Rite Southern Jurisdiction for the United States of America. In other words, the top guy in what's called the Southern Jurisdiction. The U.S. is divided into a Northern Jurisdiction and a Southern Jurisdiction for the Scottish Rite Freemasons. They are also an appendant body, sort of an offshoot of the basic, you know, standard Freemasons. So it's kind of interesting. It's a very specific subgroup, but they're very powerful. And when people speak of 32nd or 33rd degree Masons, they're really talking about the Scottish Rite, Scottish Rite Freemasons. So it wasn't just the head of his lodge. It was actually the top guy in the world for the Scottish Rite Freemasons that he presented the flag to. Now the other part of your question,
it was, do you think this was authorized by NASA? If you know.
Well, all the astronauts were allowed to take in, they were allowed personal packs to take to the moon. They were very small, sort of little suitcase size, or more like briefcase sized cases that they could take personal items to the moon with them. I know that, like, for instance, Jim Irwin on Apollo 15 took a bunch of what are called beta cloth or fiberglass type flags. They were just little sheets of this beta cloth, which is what the spacesuits were made of, with the American flag embroidered on them. And he took, I think about 150 of these to the moon, and he gave a bunch of them to Ken Johnson, who I mentioned earlier, who was in Bible study with Jim at NASA at the time. And Ken subsequently gave me one. And so I've actually, in my home here, I've actually got a little beta cloth sheet, a little fiberglass sheet flag that actually went to the moon on Apollo 15. So all the astronauts were allowed to take these personal packs with personal items with them and bring them back. In fact, one of the astronauts, Dave Scott, who was on Apollo 15, actually was drummed out of the astronaut corps because he had apparently taken a bunch of little items, and I forget what they were exactly. They were little knickknacks, like little miniature Mercury space capsules or something, little toys. And he took them to the moon, and then when he came back, he was selling them. Selling them for money. He actually got drummed out of the astronaut corps. So Buzz, you know, chose among whatever his other personal items were, and we know some of them were some wine and a couple of chalices that he used in a ceremony there on the moon. But another thing that he took was this Masonic flag. And so I don't know that he had to have NASA's permission to do that, but you know, Buzz has made no secret of his Masonic association. He's very proud of it. He wears his grandfather's 33rd degree Masonic signet ring on his left hand. And in fact, the official crew portrait for Apollo 11, if you get a high enough resolution version, you
can I've seen the ring.
But he's wearing that, not his wedding ring, for the official crew portrait. Which I don't know how well that went over with Mrs. Aldrin, the first Mrs. Aldrin. But there maybe that's the reason why she's the first Mrs. Aldrin. I don't know. But he, he clearly displays it. He wants everybody to see it. So he made no secret of his fraternal association.
Getting to the topic of Mars. You state that winds of up to 300 miles per hour blow across Cydonia. Are there any high winds blowing across the Spirit or Opportunity sites?
Well, they have had some encounters with dust devils and things like that, but it's important to remember that, that Mars will have these dust storms, these massive dust storms with winds that, that do exceed 300 miles per hour. But it's kind of a weird thing because of the lack of significant air pressure on Mars, for instance, 50 or 60 mile an hour wind would feel like a gentle breeze if you were standing on Mars because the air, the atmosphere is so thin. So velocity is not the whole story there. But there are some winds, you know, blowing on Mars. Whether they're cleaning off the solar panels or not is a pretty interesting question that I don't know that we really have the answer to.
All right, that's an interesting point. I haven't heard that one before. It seems that some of the better photos that were taken on Mars of the structures were taken by the Viking mission that occurred years before the current missions. Why is NASA displaying inferior photos in some cases or of different areas of Mars?
Well, I don't know that I 100% agree with that. I think the data from Viking was more honest, but it could afford to be more honest because there was limits to the resolution. You know, it was mm-hmm. I think at its best 25 or 30 meters per pixel, depending on the day conditions of the day and the amount of sunlight and all that kind of thing, and that was good enough to raise questions, but not good enough to really prove anything. What I've noticed is that when Mars Global Surveyor, or now Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, has photographed, specific structures that we think are interesting and potentially artificial. And actually, at this point, I would just say Richard and I are in complete agreement that they are artificial. Whenever they've done that, they always seem to manage to have, bad weather conditions or something that makes the images less than perfect. The one Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter image of the face on Mars is by far the worst MRO image I've ever seen. There's no other image that's been released that matches it in terms of the amount of noise in the image and a lack of quality. And there's even spots on it that I'm firmly convinced have been airbrushed or blur tool. They've used a blur tool on them and blurred things out. So the quality of the imagery, why isn't it better? It actually is a lot better than some of the Viking stuff, but it's nowhere near as good in either case, either with the Global Surveyor or the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's nowhere near the capacity of the camera. So it just seems like we have this really interesting, stroke of bad luck with Cydonia and with the stuff we're interested in. It just seems like, we always have bad conditions whenever we want to take a picture of something we're interested in.
I've seen photos of many strange-looking things on Mars, including a perfect man's dress shoe print that I found in the background of a panorama from NASA, and I posted it on my website. Do you think that it is possible that we have already landed there and there is more of an atmosphere than we were led to expect, or that the photos are just not legitimate in some cases?
Well, that particular image, you sent it to me today. I had a chance to look at it or earlier. I didn't really spend too much time on it. But, it could be what you say it is. I don't know why we'd send guys to Mars with dress shoes. Honestly, it could be some other kind of boot or something, or it could be something entirely different. But I guess the question is an interesting question. More and more, Richard and I, when we talk about it, we are beginning to suspect that there's a whole bunch of things about Mars that they've told us that aren't true. And I think at this point we're willing to consider the possibility that the environment of Mars, the real temperatures, the density of the atmosphere, that they may have lied to us about some of this stuff too. They may have wanted it to seem more of an uninhabitable hell than it really is. In other words, some thermal data from the Global Surveyor, actually it was from CMIS, the thermal infrared imager on the Mars Odyssey 2001 mission that showed that the surface temperature of Mars gets up to, in the summertime, as high as 68 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it would only be 68 degrees within the first 2 or 3 feet of the biosphere. In other words, if you were laying flat
right.
on your back, you'd have it'd be comfortably warm, you know, during the daytime. But above that, it would be, you know, minus 40 or something, you know, if you stood up. So it definitely proves that Mars gets warmer than we thought it did before we ever got there.
It also proves it has the right temperature for plants that would only grow.
That's correct.
With it so high.
Robust plants and stuff. And also, you can have liquid water at that temperature,
mm-hmm.
even if the atmosphere isn't that dense. And again, I think we don't really know the atmospheric composition of Mars for sure. We have pretty good ideas about it, but we don't know for sure, assuming, of course, the data that we've gotten so far is honest.
Right. Could you describe the face on Mars for us and the structure that it is sitting on top of?
Well, the face, as it's called, is a pretty popular feature. It appears to be sitting. The people that argue that it's natural, I think, they have to be blind. Because basically what you have is you have this platform that rises up off this flat plain at a place called Cydonia on Mars. It has two very long, parallel, sharp side edges to it, and then a rounded top and a rounded bottom. So the platform is beveled. It comes up to a very equal level all the way around. In other words, this beveling goes all the way around this mesa or this object and comes up to a certain level, at which point it's flat, and then there's other stuff that seems to be on top of that level. And, you know, you've got basically all the features of the face that you would want. You have a couple of brow ridges. You have a couple of eye sockets that are in the right place. The highest point on this face, it would be as if you were looking at the face straight on. The highest point on the object is the tip of what would be the nose. The nose goes down pretty much the correct distance to be a human face. There are what certainly appear to be under higher resolution nostrils in the nose. There's something of a rudimentary mouth, and on earlier images it looked like there might have been teeth in the mouth. On none of the newer, better images have we seen those, but it still raises the question in my mind as to whether or not, you know, we are really getting the real pictures or unaltered pictures of the face. And especially on the west eye socket or the left-hand eye socket as you're looking at the face, it appears to be a very human eye. There is a sort of an oval shape, exactly shaped like a human eye shape there. There's an object that appears to be a pupil within the eye, and there's even a little area that quite clearly looks like it represents a tear duct. So you've got all the structure that you would expect to see in an eye on that right-hand side. And at higher resolutions, you've also got this very grid-like kind of pattern that makes it look, it clearly looks artificial to me. It's like a cellular structure on this part of the face that's exposed, supporting the eye and this eye structure. And it's a little bit better. The eye socket on the other side, the eastern side, is less defined. It looks like the eastern side of the face might be a little bit more degraded or collapsed. Or, as some people have suggested, including Richard, it might actually be meant to be two different faces, one half human, one half more feline. That's kind of an interpretation. You know, people, I'm open to that, but I don't know if it really fits. But in any event, it looks so much like a face. It has so many features of a human face or a half-human, half-feline face that at this point I can't really argue that it's anything but an artificial construct.
Right. Why do you think that NASA is guarding the true identity of the face on Mars so closely and is doing everything in their power, including altering photographs to hide the fact that this is a true artificial monument?
Well, it's a really interesting question. You know, they are giving us data. What they are not giving us is data that is good enough to prove the thesis one way or another. And or another possibility is, and this is my belief, I believe they are altering the Mars Global Surveyor images and the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter images to take out telltale features that would clearly mark the face as artificial. So I think they're doing this. And you ask the question, why? Well, I think the last thing that NASA really wants to admit is that there was an ancient, highly advanced, because it would have to be highly advanced to build some of the structures we see around the face and the face itself. They do not want to admit that this ancient advanced civilization ever existed on Mars. And the reason for that is that if they did, they would have to come up with an explanation for what happened to them, how they were suddenly wiped out, because that apparently is what happened. So as to exactly why they want to cover it up, I'm not sure, other than the fact that I think they don't want to have to answer a bunch of very uncomfortable questions.
Do you think that we're familiar with the type of material that the face is made of?
That's a really interesting question, again. And, you know, the question of what it's made of is something that Richard really covers extensively in his first book, The Monuments of Mars. And he comes up with a lot of different ideas as to how this thing sort of trust structure. But the fact is that we do know this from some thermal infrared imaging we got from the Themis spacecraft back in 2002. What we know is that the left side and right side of the face, or the west side and the east side of the face, appear to be made of different material. Now, whether that means that one side has had the casing or the face of it, you know, the top layers of it eroded away and one side hasn't, I don't know. Or whether it means that they were actually constructed from different materials, I'm not sure either. But clearly you can see in the compositional separation that the two sides of the face are made of different materials. Exactly what those materials are, we don't know, because we don't really know how to calibrate the images that we've got from the thermal infrared, the Themis imager. So the point is that we have all the data can tell us is that this side, the left side versus the right side, are different. And it goes, by the way, right down what we perceive to be the center line of the face.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really tell us what those materials are.
I'm interested in the reflective properties of the face. It's said that it reflects 99.9% of all light that shines on it. Could the face be coated with some sort of material that glows? Or could there be some sort of power source inside the monument that lights it up, and the light is what we see?
Well, again, there's another Themis image taken in, I think, 2003, which we do discuss again in Dark Mission, that shows this incredible reflective property of the eastern half, or the right side of the face, as you're looking at it in the normal, you're looking down on the kind of images. It's a pre-dawn image. In other words, the sun hasn't even risen yet. It's like the very early part of dawn, where you just begin to see the light ticking up. It was taken at 4:30 in the morning, you know, local Martian time, and there's this incredibly reflective aspect to that. So it implies that it's made of some highly polished kind of mirrored type material, or, as you say, it's made of some material that is retaining an incredible amount of heat through the Martian night, which is an incredible feat, you know, in of itself. It's a pretty incredible feat if it's really doing that.
Mm.
We have some other stuff, some thermal infrared imaging from Cydonia that was leaked to us back in 2002, or leaked to anybody that, I guess, went to the right website at the time, that when it's properly processed, seems to show this vast city below the monuments of Mars, below the Cydonia plain, that we theorize is actually below, we think the ground at Cydonia around the face is not ground, it's actually ice. And below that, on top of that ice, is a very, very thin layer of reddish dust, the kind of dust you have everywhere on Mars. But this imagery seems to be penetrating down into the, you know, underneath part. The problem is that what we saw, the detail that we saw in these leaked images, was so bright and so extensive that it really couldn't have been, we wouldn't see that much return on the signal unless the power was on, unless somebody had left the lights on down there.
That's what I was talking about.
That's a possibility that, you know, we have to seriously consider, because we firmly believe the imagery that we received is real. It's definitely in conflict with what is now posted on the Themis website. We've already proven that they changed the specific website with the image on it sometime after our guy Keith Laney downloaded it, the original. So, you know, I mean, we have to say honestly that, you know, everything's on the table. The issue is that once you say there's something artificial on Mars, then every explanation is automatically on the table. You can't say, well, there couldn't possibly be anything alive down there, or there couldn't possibly be anything still active down there. Because
well,
the data just pushes you to say, well, the only way we can explain this is that there's still heat down there. There's still power emanating from it.
Well, this brings a question to mind that I hadn't written down, but it would seem to me that if this is the case, then if there is a power source there, it would either have to be nuclear or it would have to be coming from inside the planet itself to still be around after millions of years, you know? What do you think?
Well, yeah, or it could be some alternative source of power that we haven't figured out yet. It could be, you know, what Richard likes to talk about, a hyper-dimensional source of power.
Right, right.
The thing is that, you know, even nuclear, I mean, we placed the catastrophe that wiped out the civilization on Mars, at least the first civilization that we think built the monuments of Mars, at about 65 million years ago. I don't know of anything that could stay going for 65 million years. The question is the underground city that we see, is that a previous epoch or is it a more recent epoch?
Mm-hmm.
Either way, it appears to be abandoned. It appears to be in ruins. But yet there still does appear to be some energy emanating from it, or at least heat, because heat's what's showing up in the thermal infrared. So, you know, I could speculate, but I really don't know what could
cause. Of course, right. You state in the book that the face is made up of polygonal segments, such as the ones used on computers to build images and programs like games, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Could this image be constructed that way to alert us to the fact that maybe there's a building that contains some kind of futuristic computing facility?
No, I don't really think that's what we meant. What we talked about was that the face, you know, does have these, in this one thermal infrared image, you can clearly see, you know, geometric panels, structure on the right side, and other images like around the eye structure, you see this grid pattern that sort of vaguely resembles some of like Buckminster Fuller's tetrahedral. In other words, it seems to be built up of a lot of little triangles. And what the analogy we were making is that, you know, in computer 3D modeling, that's how everything is achieved now. They build, you know, they make billions of little triangles put together to make the shapes, even the smooth rounded 3D shapes that we see in computer games like the, you know, Doom 3 and Quake 4 and things like that. So that's kind of the analogy we're making, that maybe there's something fundamental about that particular type of construction that makes it inherently strong or inherently desirable as a means of building, you know, massive.
Oh, so you weren't intending to say that might be a message of any kind.
No, I don't know. It makes sense because part of the so-called mathematical message of Sedonia that Richard talked about, you know, a lot,
right,
appears to be focused on tetrahedrons. And really, when you're talking about triangles, you're really talking about little 3D solid tetrahedrons building all these shapes up in the 3D software. So that's interesting. We just think it's kind of an interesting, you know, analogy. Maybe the face is made up of a lot of little, you know, tetrahedral pyramids.
How long do you think that NASA can keep this secret? And do you think that they can ultimately prevent private companies and other countries from getting into space and discovering these things?
Well, that's an interesting question again. You know, how long can NASA keep a lid on this? I think they can keep a lid on it as long as they want, because there's a massive segment of the population that doesn't believe anything until they're told by the anchor on CNN or by the president or by, you know, some authority figure like a NASA scientist to believe it. So if they're not told to believe it, they never will. And, you know, I just think that that's a huge amount of our population thinks that way. As we look, you know, at our culture, in my opinion, we're becoming dumber and dumber. you know, our schools are useless. I mean, you know, I'm not going to tell you what my political affiliation is, but I'm just appalled at the way the schools have just deteriorated in the last 20 or 30 years since I went to school, and they weren't that great then. And we don't teach science anymore. We don't teach critical thinking anymore. We teach our kids what to think. You know, we inculcate them with all this propaganda. We tell them what to think, not how to think. And as a result of that, we just don't have kids that are really very bright anymore. They just really don't think for themselves. They're dependent on experts to tell them this is real or this is true or that's real or that's true. So, I think that unless NASA wants to come out for whatever reason and say, yeah, this stuff is for real, I think a huge segment of the population is never going to believe it, no matter how much evidence we might amass.
I agree with you on that. You already spoke about this, but you inferred that Mars contained ruins of cities, both in Cydonia and in other areas. Tell us about the photos that were taken of them by the Russian infrared cameras.
Well, excuse me. Back in 1989, so about 13 or 14 years previous to the famous thermal infrared images of Cydonia and some other parts of Mars, there was a Russian mission called Phobos 2 that went to Mars and took a series of thermal infrared images, the first ones ever taken of the planet. And in an area called, I think it was called Hadaspes Chaos, they took an image that showed a pattern basically underneath the ground that looked like a cityscape. It looked pretty much like, you know, Los Angeles. And at the time, there were some programs on British TV where scientists came out and said, you know, if this photograph was taken of Earth, we would assume it was a buried city, and we would go excavate it and try to see, you know, what things were there. And it featured some, I think the guy's name was Dr. John Beckles. And there was also some Russian scientists at the time who came out and revealed the data, and they concurred with that opinion. And, later on, we had kind of a confirmation of that in the same thermal infrared images of Cydonia. It looks like that sort of city-type pattern is around on more than one place on Mars.
Since we're talking about photos, do you think you could tell my readers exactly what a pixel is and the difference in the size of the picture, the difference that the size of the material and the pixels make in the photographic process?
Sure. A pixel is just a picture element. That's what it stands for. And it's simply a unit of, I guess, measurement in a digital image. In other words, one pixel can make up a certain amount of space. It can have a certain amount of information in it. In cases of thermal infrared imaging, it can have color values assigned to it. In a grayscale image, which is what most of the photography of Mars is, it generally has a color value from 0 to 256. So you can have up to 256 different shades of gray that pixel can represent. Now, using digital enhancement techniques, you can, you know, sort of take one pixel and from that pixel you can determine what other pixels around it, what color they are, and then you can use that to sort of take a guess or do an average of their area. So when we talk about pixel resolution, for instance, 1 meter per pixel resolution is really good, meaning that 1 meter, about a yardstick, 39 inches I guess it is, 1 meter, you imagine that distance, what it means is that each pixel in a given digital image represents 1 square meter of space. So it would be, a 39 inch stick, about a yardstick, with a square shape, would be represented by one pixel. At that resolution, you can resolve highways and roads, and you can resolve vehicles on the road. You can't tell what the vehicle is. I mean, you can tell, semi-trucks and tractor trailers from individual passenger cars. But that's a good example of what a 1 meter per pixel resolution will get you.
Right.
Some of the new images, like the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, gets down to much smaller than that, just a few inches per pixel. And really, with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter images, they're better than 1 meter per pixel most of the time, again, depending on lighting, depending on contrast values, depending on a whole bunch of camera settings, whether there's any clouds in the sky at the time. But that thing can be so good that it should be able to, in other words, if you and I were sitting in a room together with no roof on it, you should be able to see the room and the couch and the chairs and you and me sitting there. You won't maybe be able to tell it's you and me, Ken, you and I, but you'd be able to tell there's two people sitting in the chair talking to each other. So that's how good some of the new cameras are.
Right, right. So in other words, what you're saying is when they take a, when NASA took a photo and maybe it was 100 meters wide, that 100 meters represented one dot in the photo.
Exactly, one little dot.
That's
one little dot. And with the Viking images, 30 meters. So basically 39 inches, you know, yardstick, a little more than a yard. Yardsticks are, let's imagine, just to say a yardstick, like 39 yardsticks, wide and 39 yardsticks tall represented, or 30 yardsticks wide and 30 yardsticks tall represented one dot.
Right.
And with the Mars Global Surveyor, the theoretical image resolution, depending on the altitude of the spacecraft and everything else, could get as good as 1 meter per pixel. It never really achieved that. It was about 4 meters per pixel. But Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter is even better than that.
Another problem with some of the NASA photos of objects on Mars seems to be the angle that the camera was at when taking the photo. Would you tell us how this affects the photo and the object's appearance?
Yeah, a good example of that is the first Mars Global Surveyor image of the face on Mars taken in 1998, where they waited until the spacecraft had passed, gone, from above the face, passed over the face, and was then looking back upstream, basically, toward it. Imagine if somebody put a camera underneath your chin and was looking kind of up at the bottom of your nose to take a picture of your face.
That's a disgusting image,
that's what the image was. And right. The thing about it, it was actually off to the side. It was as if it crossed from left to right at a downward angle across your face and then shot up underneath your face. But, so it ended up with the left side of the face was very distorted and you couldn't see much of it. And you did get a good view of the nostrils, which I think really upset them. I don't think they really wanted to see that. They were probably real upset when they actually saw real nostrils in the nose. The thing about that specific angle is that there's a whole bunch of other factors that made that image really, really bad, I guess I'll say.
When you speak about a mathematical message left for us by the builders on Mars, exactly what are you referring to?
Well, what Richard and another researcher named Errol Torin found was that this one pyramidal object, pentagonal pyramidal object, in the Sidonia region, very near the face, called the D&M Pyramid, had an internal geometry. It had certain specific repeating geometric angular measurements. And that same set of mathematical constants and measurements also was present in the broader Sidonia complex involving a bunch of previously identified potentially artificial structures in the area. And that mathematical message seemed to have something to do, the geometry seemed to be focused on tetrahedrons. And a tetrahedron is a very simple base, four-sided pyramid. It's made up of four sides of equilateral triangles. It's basically like a 60-degree equilateral triangle. And imagine a pyramid with three sides and a bottom all shaped in that same way, and that's a tetrahedron. It's basically the simplest of the so-called platonic solids. It's the simplest solid shape that you can get. And what they decided was that what the message seemed to be was, look at tetrahedrons, and in fact, look at circumscribed tetrahedrons. In other words, a tetrahedron wrapped or encased by a sphere. And, this led them to look at a lot of old mathematics, very early stuff that was done back in the early days of physics, that also seemed to point to this tetrahedral geometry as somehow being really significant in electromagnetism and physics, although it was eventually sort of stripped out of some of John Clerk Maxwell's original equations, and the tetrahedral component of it was all sort of lost. But that was the mathematical message, and it was not a thing where they just started drawing lines until they found something that looked like a monument. I mean, there were all these objects that were geomorphically anomalous, that didn't belong, that looked artificial, and there was this internal geometry in the D&M, and the same geometry repeated on the the bigger, broader complex of different monuments. And truthfully, you know, on Earth, there's a lot of significant mathematical relationships in all of the major ancient ruin sites, like Teotihuacan in Mexico and Giza Plateau and things like that. So
I was just going to ask you that.
Yeah, it's very consistent with what you know, with what we see at Cydonia on Mars. And that led Torin and Hoagland to really dig into, you know, what is tetrahedral physics, what does tetrahedral geometry really mean, and it led into the whole hyperdimensional physics concept.
Well, there's a question I just have to ask, you know, because I was kind of stunned by it. I'd like to know why you or Hoagland or both of you thought to go back to the original work of the mathematician Maxwell, who worked on hyperdimensional physics, well, when we thought we already knew all about his work. In case those people out there don't know what I'm talking about, I just want to refer to one thing. His mathematical proofs where certain things were left out by people that followed after him, you know. What made you think that maybe this was the case?
Well, I think after after Richard sort of came to the conclusion that the message of Cydonia was look to your tetrahedron, as he likes to put it, you know, mm-hmm. look at tetrahedral physics, tetrahedral geometry. He met a guy named Tom Bearden who told him that this sort of geometry was important in some of the early work of Maxwell, and I think it was Tom Bearden that turned Richard on to the early work of Maxwell and some other people. And he went back and he bought old textbooks and he eventually found the original mathematical treatises that Maxwell had done and realized that originally Maxwell was trying to solve certain problems in electromagnetism and gravity and that he had in all of his equations included a scalar component, a higher dimensional component. In other words, in order to solve a problem mm-hmm. Of how waves propagated through space, he had always included the idea that there were more dimensions than just the three that we perceive length, width, and breadth, or length, height, and breadth. So it was a fourth dimension, or a fifth dimension, or a sixth dimension were necessary. Now, what those dimensions looked like, nobody really knew. They were somewhat modeled, you know, mathematically, but you know, you don't need to know what they look like or how they operate to be able to determine whether or not they have an effect.
It's sort of a Hutchison effect you're talking about.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess mm-hmm. I would say that. I don't know enough about that to really make that analogy.
Well, that's how he explained it to me when I interviewed him.
mm-hmm. Okay.
What do you think that a scientist, even one working for the government, would want to hide the fact that there are artificial structures on Mars when ultimately this may be proven and they'll look incompetent? I mean, why would a scientist want to go down in history looking this way?
Well, that's a really good question. And it leads me to two, there's two possibilities that we've talked about over the years. We think the first issue is that they don't want to admit that there are ruins on Mars, because the first question you're going to get at the press conference after you say, by the way, there's artificial structures on Mars, is what happened to them? Mm-hmm. What happened to that civilization? And the answer to that question is not particularly comfortable. They'd have to admit that there was some sort of very intense cataclysm that destroyed a civilization that was obviously more advanced than we were. In my opinion, extremely destabilizing to society. It would probably result in a lot of War of the Worlds type hysteria, which we think, you know, is clearly what they were concerned about and what they remain concerned about. And I just think that is a very, very destabilizing concept. So I don't think they're ever going to admit it. Now, I don't think there's that many guys on the mm-hmm. inside that really know about it. I think it's a handful. I don't think there's that many guys that really know this.
Well, it would seem to indicate that if there was a war, for example, then whoever destroyed these people actually hopped from the moon to Mars to who knows where to do this. In other words, they were spread out across the solar system, and it was systematically eliminated.
Right. I mean, we talk about the Mars Tidal Model, a paper we put up on the web in 2001, and it's also included in Dark Vision. And we talk about our belief that we think we've proven beyond any doubt that Mars is not a planet, that it was a moon of another planet that was destroyed, that exploded, which was, you know, the reason, the catastrophe that happened to Mars that wiped out the civilization, that ripped away half the planet's atmosphere and made it, you know, almost uninhabitable. And, you know, I mean, you just don't want to say that to people. By the way, either A, planets can explode, which is kind of scary considering we live on one, or B, there was a war, you know, 65 million years ago, or however long it was ago, and a planet was blown up deliberately. I mean, either way, people are not going to be real happy about that. And, you know, you're not going to be able to get people to go to work and be productive and be calm and not overthrow the power structure. So I think it's essential to preserving the power structure.
Do you really think this is true? I mean, I know you're saying what the government thinks would happen, but your own view, do you think this is really true?
Well, I think it's a lot less true now than it used to be. I mean, the Brookings Report, which is a big part of our thesis in the book, the NASA commission at the very dawn of the agency itself, says that if you do discover artifacts in the solar system, you should consider withholding the information. Or, you know, you should consider maybe telling people by means of conditioning them through the mass media, through, you know, I assume movies, TV, popular books, novels, science fiction, comic books, all these kinds of things that we pretty much see, you know, throughout our culture and society. So I think a culture that's been, you know, raised on Star Trek and Lost in Space and Star Wars and all this stuff is probably less threatened by the concept. But, you know, there are still, as we found out on September 11, 2001, we found out there's still a lot of people that have very, I would say, primitive, fundamental religious beliefs that are going to be desperately threatened by this news. And it doesn't take very many people to cause a lot of chaos. I mean, look at the situation in Iraq where you had 20,000 people, essentially, is how big they thought the so-called insurgency was. Out of a country of 25 million, you have 20,000 guys, most of whom aren't even from Iraq, who caused a lot of chaos for 4 or 5 years before we finally got kept.
Well, that's assuming you believe the numbers.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I mean, again, I think I don't see any reason to doubt the numbers. And the thing is, it doesn't take very many people, you know, less than 1% of the population to go nuts on you to cause an awful lot of issues.
That's true, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's my only point. Maybe I'd use a different example, but it doesn't take that many people to cause a lot of problems.
Well, tell us about Ken Johnson when he was ordered to destroy the NASA photos and how he saved them.
Well, Ken was responsible at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory for a whole lot of lunar samples of actual rocks that were brought back, a bunch of photographs that were taken of the rocks, and some other photographs that were general Apollo handheld photography you know, taken by the astronauts on the various missions. He had 4 sets of that data that he was responsible for and responsible for preserving. And at one point, and I think 1972, his boss came to him and said, you are supposed to destroy all the pictures. And Ken said, well, I don't think I want to do that. I mean, these are early generation, near original, I think they're all first generation prints made from the original negatives of the photos that were taken by the astronauts on their 6 missions to 5 missions to the moon, the 6 missions that were successful to the moon. And, you know, he said, can I donate them to university libraries or schools or something like that, you know, academic institutions? And they said, you know, no, the orders are to destroy all 4 sets of these images. And it doesn't make any sense except in the context of if there was stuff on the images that NASA could not control, that they would want to only have 1 set of prints and negatives that they could exert control over. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. Of course you'd want to donate them to academic institutions, but he asked again, he basically begged, and the final word came down, no, it came down from headquarters, NASA headquarters, you must destroy all the images. So he did destroy three sets of them, but he couldn't bring himself to destroy them all, so he kept some of the images himself, very few of them, and he donated the rest of them to his alma mater, Oklahoma City University in Oklahoma. A lot of those images have subsequently disappeared over the years since 1972, but it's just, it's one of these episodes that just, it makes no sense unless somebody inside NASA had an agenda to hide what was on those pictures.
Right, right. What did some of the photos show that made them so valuable? I mean, aside from them being invaluable as an historical record.
Well, when Richard got a hold of them from Ken, he started doing, you know, sort of exposing them to the same image enhancement techniques he'd been using on some other lunar orbiter photos. And what he found was that when you enhance the background of these images, you don't even need to enhance the images. If you look at some of the basic raw scans, you will see little blue dots and things in the sky above the astronauts that should not be there. And when you enhance them, this amazing gridwork structure, this glittering, reflective, glass-like gridwork structure appears above the astronauts' heads in a whole bunch of these images. And, you know, we've now actually got new high-resolution scans from the current generation of NASA images, NASA negatives, that are in the archives now, and they confirm these same, you know, obviously or apparently artificial structures towering over the astronauts. So that's what it showed. It showed artifacts. It showed the ruins of a massive scaffolding type of structures over the astronauts on several of the Apollo missions.
Mm. Has Ken Johnson ever suffered either legally, physically, or psychologically for taking these photos, if you know?
Well, not taking the photos because he didn't take them.
No, I mean receiving them.
No,
you know, I don't mean actually.
He didn't really suffer any consequences until just recently when Dark Mission came out and we retold Ken's story as we had told it actually at some other times on the web. We told Ken's story again. Ken had been part of a Jet Propulsion Laboratory program called Solar System Ambassadors, which are unpaid volunteer positions where they basically are sponsored by JPL, and they go around and they promote space and engineering and space exploration to young people, kids in schools, you know, that kind of thing. They promote science and engineering and so forth. And because Ken was involved in Dark Mission and associated with myself and Richard Hoagland, he was subsequently fired from his position as a Solar System Ambassador. They pulled his credentials. Now, this happened after an NBC reporter, and I use that with quotation marks around it, named James Oberg, had basically raised a stink with the gal, the lady who runs the Solar System Ambassador program at JPL. And, you know, he wrote a very sparmy letter that implied all sorts of things about Ken and his background. And
that's terrible.
Implicated mm-hmm. that Ken's credentials were not what he made them out to be. And you know, the part that was really, really nauseating was that James Oberg and Ken Johnson had known each other for several years and had worked together at NASA back in the 1970s. And, you know, and Oberg pretended that he didn't know who Ken was at all, which is, we just don't believe to be true at all.
Mm. How did you and Hoagland discover that certain NASA probes and Apollo landings were tied in with ancient Egyptian ceremonies?
Well, I can't take credit for originally discovering that. That was Richard's concept, although I did a lot of work on it later with him and sort of developing the model, the standardized model of this. But essentially what it came down to is that once Ken explained to Richard that Buzz Aldrin had been a 33rd degree Scottish, or 32nd degree at the time, Scottish Rite Freemason, and now 33rd degree, and Richard began to understand what the Freemasons were, and he began to understand that the Freemasons, at their core belief system, the Scottish Rite believes that, you know, these ancient Egyptian gods, Isis and Osiris and Horus and Seth, were real beings. They were real creatures that actually walked the earth and worshipped them as gods. Once he understood that all this was the case, he began to think about the fact that the ancient Egyptian religion was a stellar religion. In other words, all these gods were represented by specific constellations or stars in the sky. Isis was represented by the star Sirius, the brightest star in the night sky. Osiris is represented by the constellation Orion. And then in 10 stuff, this stack of stuff, he found this original Apollo patch, Apollo program patch for the program the way it originally had been created. And right there on that patch is the constellation of Orion. And it makes no sense because Apollo and Orion don't have any connection in any kind of mythology. Orion is associated with Osiris. It's an Egyptian deity. Apollo is Greek. There's no real connection. So, he kind of thought to himself, well, what the heck is Orion doing out here? And it's weird because I can even remember as a kid seeing that patch and wondering what the heck that was all about.
Yeah, right.
I didn't even know what Orion really was, but I knew that it seemed like a very odd patch. So the question occurred to Richard as he read through some stuff. I wonder if there's any connection in this. I wonder if the fact that there's so many Freemasons at NASA and the fact that there are that they believe in these ancient gods, I wonder if there's anything in the stars that they may have landed at a certain time or a certain place. So he was able to use some astronomical software to go back and look at the landing of Apollo 11, and then he got more interested as he discovered this communion ceremony I spoke of earlier with Buzz Aldrin. And he timed that. I mean, they went and looked at transcripts and took a pretty good guess as to when that ceremony would have taken place. They plugged in the time, the location. By the way, it was 33 minutes after they landed. And sure enough, there was this star Sirius, or Isis, in the religion, in the ancient Egyptian religion, and a very important goddess in the Masonic belief system, at 19.5 degrees above the landing site, which is this, again, related to tetrahedral geometry. That 19.5 degrees is very important. And as you begin to dig more and more into these special events, these major events in the space program, you discovered that they consistently would do certain events when the stars representing some of these ancient Egyptian gods, Isis, Osiris, or Horus, were at these different power positions, 19.5 degrees, 33 degrees, or on the horizon or on the meridian, which is where the Egyptian religions considered to be sacred spots in the sky.
And he was able to do this with very common software, Redshift, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Redshift yeah. 2, as a matter of fact, yeah.
What do you think that Carl Sagan was so against the idea that intelligent life once appeared on Mars?
Well, Carl was not against that idea. Early in his career, he was very experimental. He was very open about life on other planets. He himself and his seminal TV series Cosmos made a big deal of these tetrahedral-shaped mountains on Mars called the Pyramids of Elysium. At least that's what he called them. And he was always talking about this kind of thing. And interestingly, he always, whenever he would criticize the UFO community in his various debunking efforts, he pretty much left Richard Hoagland, even though they knew each other extremely well, out of the equation. He never criticized Richard by name. He never attacked him by name, which I always thought really interesting. But he did at one point write a propaganda piece in Parade magazine against the Face on Mars, criticizing the science behind it. It used deliberately distorted pictures of the face to make its points. It was just a piece of propaganda, and that broke off their relationship. Their friendship pretty much ended at that point. But a few years later, this is a story that's not in the book. A few years later, there was a Mars conference, and there were people there like Gerard O'Neill, who's a very famous futurist of the late 70s and 80s, and Carl was there, and Richard was at this conference, again, wanting to talk about Cydonia. So Richard went, as there was this little panel discussion going on with Carl and Jerry O'Neill, and I think Isaac Asimov might have been there, I don't recall exactly. But there were these famous names in science and science fiction. And Richard went there and sat in the front row. And Carl was eventually asked the question by Gerard O'Neill. Basically, he said, look, why do we even bother going to Mars? Why send any more probes to Mars? Why send anything out? Why do this stuff if all we're going to do is find a bunch of dead rocks and no life? And what's the point? And Richard said that at that point, Carl turned and looked him right in the eye, which he had not done for, at that point, 7 or 8 years. And looking at Richard the entire time, he said, because, Jerry, Mars holds surprises. So Carl, you know, as Richard put it to me once, he's still waiting for the disc that Carl left.
Well, listen, I've been talking to you for an hour. I don't want to wear you out. I mean, I'd love to. I got a whole bunch more questions, but I want to be fair to you. Would it be all right to ask you some more, or have you had enough?
I have had enough, but I'm also willing to go on. I mean, this is good stuff. Why don't we do another 20 minutes or so?
Great. I can't help but be fascinated by the fact that the rovers on Mars sometimes have what looks like machine parts in a few of their photos. I saw the robot head that you have a photo of in your book that was photographed on Mars, and that's of particular interest. When you see these objects, do you have an opinion on how far advanced the race that created them might have been?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because this weekend at the Conscious Life Expo out here in Los Angeles, Richard was there and I was there, and there was a guy who was displaying a lot of pictures of various artifacts that have been taken, of the rovers. I mean, this is a whole bunch of stuff that clearly looks like machinery of some kind and sheet metal formed parts and things that, as an aerospace engineer, I look at them and they're obviously manufactured. They're obviously not rocks. And this guy was pretty intense about the whole thing and kind of gave Richard a hard time for not making a bigger deal out of it. But the truth is that, you know, there's lots of artifacts in all these pictures. So what I would say is that as I look at this stuff, it doesn't look that advanced. In a lot of cases, it looks like stuff that's at right around our level. Now, it may be true that in the next, you know, 20 or 30 or 50 years, that we won't advance that much. But a lot of this stuff looks like familiar technology. It looks like sheet metal form parts. It looks to be like stuff, air conditioners, you know, engines, pumps, things that you would recognize as in today's mechanical engineering.
I've noticed that myself, yes. Yes, I've noticed that, and it sort of made me wonder, you know, because it doesn't fit in with the fact that you could have a race of people that could fly to all these different places, and yet some of their technology would be so primitive, you know.
Well, you know, the thing is, I mean, I think, you know, we're still, I mean, air conditioning technology, how much different is it going to get than it is today? It's still going to require some sort of fan and pump and cooling and, you know, I mean, maybe it's just the same. So, you know, we don't know. Also, These are items that have been recently uncovered, and by recently, I mean probably in the last few thousand years. So we don't know how old they are. We don't know. There could have been various different levels of technological civilization on Mars. I mean, as we look at the Sidonia infrared pictures, we have this huge cityscape, and then we have the monuments above the surface that we think is there, and you know they could definitely be different levels of engineering. Mm-hmm. So, to me, it doesn't surprise me that we're seeing this kind of stuff because literally almost everywhere the rovers go on Mars, I think they went there looking for this stuff, frankly. So
it looks that way, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
NASA has indicated many times that they were going to conduct photo sweeps that we know would have yielded spectacular results, only to disappoint us with subpar photos and even photos that many say were altered. Do you think that there may be a psychological reason for this and that maybe they wanted us to lose interest in these photos and indeed the entire subject?
No, I think that they are obligated. And again, we talk about this religion that they seem to be following in Dark Mission, but I think to some extent they are obligated to give us that which we ask for. If we ask for photos, if we ask for images of certain things, I think that there's some part of the whole structure of their civilization, you know, whatever creed they're following, that requires them to give it to us, but it doesn't require them to admit to us what they are. And I think it may be, you know, that they don't have to give us the whole thing. So as I look at the pictures that we've received, I think they're good enough. It's interesting because they're always good enough to advance the ball a few more yards forward, but we never get the real smoking gun. We never get anything that's good enough to flatly say, okay, you know, you got to be kidding me. This is obviously artificial. Like teeth, for instance. If there were clearly defined teeth in the mouth of the face on Mars, that would pretty much put an end to the argument that it's a pile of rocks.
Mm-hmm.
Yet in all the images, that area of the face is pretty much blank, whereas on earlier lower resolution images, there appeared to be something there. And the fact that they're lower resolution shouldn't make people be too skeptical, because the truth is that there's a lot of logical reasons, and I think we outlined it in the book, why, even though it's lower resolution, pretty much if it's showing these features in two different images taken at two different times, there has to be something there that represented the shadows of the objects that we saw. Yet, with the higher resolution images, there's nothing there that could have even possibly created the illusion of teeth in the mouth.
Well, there was work where there was some photo enhancement on some of the earlier photos, and teeth were clearly visible.
Yeah. And the thing about it is that those two images, those two Viking images, were taken, you know, from different angles with different sunlight, and there
right.
was nothing. In other words, they couldn't be image artifacts because there was nothing else that looked like those teeth looked anywhere else on the images when they were enhanced. So that I'm firmly convinced there was something there. Yet when we get the four or five pictures of the face on Mars we have now that show the mouth area, There's nothing there that could have even caused the illusion, the mistaken illusion, if it was that there were teeth in the mouth. So to
right.
me, that's always been one case. That and the fact that there are these enormous blank areas on the NASA versions of pictures of the face on Mars, as I would separate them from the European images, there are always these big blank areas on the face that just to me look blatantly tampered with.
I'm going to ask you now about the Kennedy assassination, since the book ties Kennedy in with the space race, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
There have been many theories on a Kennedy assassination over the years. Your book indicates that President Kennedy had offered a deal to the Russians several times where they would be able to join our space program.
Mm-hmm.
And on about the fourth offer, Khrushchev was about to accept. And we know this because his son testified to the fact. And just a few days before Khrushchev accepted, Kennedy was killed. First of all, you think this reason above all was why he was killed?
Yeah, I do. I've looked at all the different conspiracy theories involving the Kennedy assassination, and none of them, to me, rose to the level that it would take to be worth killing the President of the United States over. You know, killing a president is a really, really dangerous game to play because people are going to be naturally extremely curious about the circumstances. To me, you know, anti-Castro Cubans, Castro himself, the mafia, the Russians, none of these, the military-industrial complex wanting to keep the Vietnam War going, none of those add up to a good enough reason to try to kill somebody, especially the President of the United States. But if you're talking about sharing our most advanced technology at the time, which was rocketry and rocket and guidance technology, with our mortal Cold War enemy, the Soviet Union, or on top of that, if there was knowledge within the intelligence community of what was on the moon and what was on Mars, in other words, ruins, that they would find ancient extraterrestrial technology there, that easily, to me, rises to a level of, okay, we got to get rid of this guy. Because clearly he's now endangering, you know, the Union or Western civilization or whatever. At least that's something to me that adds up. None of the other stuff has ever really added up to a big enough reason for Kennedy to have been killed.
The book goes on to further implicate then Vice President Johnson and Representative Thomas as being part of or the leaders of the plot, and shows a photo of Johnson being sworn in and partially facing Thompson and smiling while Thomas winks at him, and a still grieving Jacqueline Kennedy is at his side. Has anything ever turned up to support this contention?
Well, you know. Well, I think we lay out in the book all the circumstantial evidence. Why would Thomas and why would Johnson be part of a conspiracy to get rid of Kennedy. And you know, as we lay it out, Thomas was one of the leading congressional critics of Kennedy's plan, which he only made public with the final offer to Khrushchev in September of 1963, to share our space technology with the Russians. he was very close with Johnson, and I think that, you know, in terms of, is there other evidence that supports this conclusion? We don't have anything new at this time that supports it, but I think we lay out a really strong case in the book that these guys all had, you know, motive, means, and opportunity to be behind the assassination. And that Wink photograph, which is absolutely confirmed, it's absolutely genuine, is about the most incongruous thing I think I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine, with a president having been assassinated, the vice president, literally moments, just a couple of moments after being sworn in as president, smiling under any circumstances, and the wink of Congressman Thomas to Johnson is just absolutely, absolutely incongruous. Why would you guys? Why would you? You know, to me, as I look at that, as I wrote it in the book, it says to me, we got him. You know, we got away with it. And I just, what an inappropriate moment. It just doesn't make, to me, it doesn't make any sense that anybody would do that if they weren't part of something bigger or weren't part of some conspiracy, you know, part of the conspiracy to eliminate Jack Kennedy.
Do you think that there is some sort of agreement between countries about keeping data secret if it shows any indication of alien life?
I think that's a possibility. I know that some of the real high-resolution film and imagery coming back, I think, from the Japanese mission, there are clear signs of tampering with some of those images. So it wouldn't surprise me if that's the case. Do I think that? Yeah, I think it's a distinct possibility. But what I've noticed is real interesting is that, you know, we have this Mars Express spacecraft from the European Space Agency, the ESA, and there's actually an article on the darkmission.net website, which is a deleted version, a deleted section of the book that didn't make it into the book, that talks about this mission and these photographs that they've taken. And in their photos, even though they're kind of at the limits of the resolution where you could say, yeah, for sure you can see something here, their photographs of the face in Sidonia appear to me to be more genuine than any of the versions we've had from NASA, and we kind of talk about that in this article. It was something that I wish we could have put in Dark Mission. I guess I'll have to put it in the revised edition. But in other words, what I'm saying is that...
Dark Mission 2.
Yeah, I hope so. I think there's a distinct possibility that there is such an agreement, but I clearly see that there are some countries and some organizations which seem to be, you know, fighting that agreement, or seem to be at least unhappy with it, to the point where they're putting stuff out that a logical person can say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't really look the same as the images NASA's put out.
Mm. It's been said that another Sphinx has been discovered on Mars. Are you familiar with that?
I don't know which one we're talking about, actually.
Oh, I had read that, and I saw a photo of what they think is a full-size Sphinx. I don't know exactly where it was located because the picture didn't indicate it. And I was just wondering if you had heard anything about that.
Well, I haven't heard of one besides the one that we thought maybe might be at the Pathfinder landing site. I mean, we looked at some super-resolution images of the Pathfinder landing site a few years ago, and there was an object that bore an eerie resemblance to a Sphinx, some distance away from the rover in one of the major panorama images. And again, we talk about that in Dark Mission, and we show you some of the pictures there. So if it's separate from that, I'd really be interested. In fact, you know, Ken, if you can find me that.
It might be the one in the book that I'm thinking of.
Okay, well, it might be. But I mean, it was just, as I looked at this thing, you know, again, it's right at the limits of resolution. They give it to you where you can almost make it out that you can't really say absolutely that's what it is. And there was something that looked a lot like a Sphinx, not too far away from the rover. Now, I have there is a Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter image of the Mars Pathfinder landing site, and I had hoped to be able to take that and work with it, and look at that image and see if I could find this things from above, you know, rather than a
right.
straight shot. But I honestly, the images that you download now from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter website for that don't. I can't get them to work on my computer. If I try to convert them to TIFF files, I can't get them to open. And I just had all kinds of trouble. It's one of those things out there that I really like to resolve that question. You know, what is this very odd, very block-like, very Sphinx-like looking structure that we see in the Pathfinder images?
Can I ask you what software you're using?
Yeah, I'm using a couple of different. I'm using Photoshop, and I'm using another Corel image processor. And I've tried the different processors or image processing programs that actually download the, I think they're IMQ files that the Reconnaissance Orbiter images come in. And I've had nothing but trouble. I had a guy who sent me a CD with a bunch of the images broken up in the TIFFs, and they wouldn't open. So I just, and I've not talked to other people that have had the same problem with these images. So, you know, I don't know if it's me or if it's just there's something wrong with the images themselves. But it's one of those things that's on my list to actually resolve at some point. Maybe I can get Richard to open them. Maybe he'll be able to open them and tell me, you know, what's on them.
A series of tubes has been found on Mars that were thought to extend a few hundred feet, and recently it was discovered that they also went underground and extended into what seems to be a building in Cydonia. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, we found some. Actually, I think Arthur C. Clarke was one of the first ones to bring this up. Richard may have brought this out and sent it to me before Arthur Clarke. I think the sequence is that Richard posted this image of this so-called glass tube on Mars, and Arthur Clarke found it and saw it and made a big deal out of it, and he thought it might be alive because you see these, or fossil, you see this sort of rib-like structure of these tubes that are exposed where there's a rift in the ground. And they extend for several hundred feet, and there looks like there's an object inside what looks to be a translucent tube. And NASA tried to claim that these were actually concave, that really our minds were just playing a trick on us, and it wasn't really and there were a series of sand dunes in a ravine, and we had Ron Nix, one of our consulting geologists, pretty much debunked that, and then we had some 3D shape from shading work that was done by a couple of people who worked with us, and they clearly showed that these were raised tubular type of structures with these sort of ribs spaced very evenly all along the structure. Later on when we got the thermal infrared images of Cydonia from the Mars Odyssey 2001 CMIS imager, we found these tubes, similar types of tubes, coming out of a fortress in Cydonia, an object called the fortress, and the thermal infrared showed that it extended underground and went even below what you could see visible in the visible light images. And there were other similar tubes that seemed to come out of an object we call, or an area we call the train station in Cydonia, and this tube goes along this sort of meandering, winding road and goes right underneath kind of a symmetrical mesa, symmetrical object in Cydonia. So, we've seen these things now on visual images. We've seen them on thermal infrared images, and there appear to be some, you know, tubular type structures on Mars in various places that you know we can pretty much confirm are there. And they maybe are transportation systems, maybe for moving water. Who knows?
Some of these ruins on the moon are quite unusual. One that comes to mind is a glass tower that soars into the sky. Do you think that we're capable today of building a structure like that on the moon, or is
I don't think we're capable. I don't know if we're capable of building a structure like that, but what we are right now proposing that when we do get to the moon, if we do return and we do build a lunar base, that we build it out of glass, and we build it out of lunar glass. And there's tons and tons of glass right on the surface of the moon. It's very easy to get to. And in a vacuum environment like the moon with no moisture, glass has actually become stronger than steel. It's about 2 times stronger than steel. So essentially it's the perfect it's the perfect material for building a lunar base to protect you from meteorites and radiation and other things like that.
An interesting theory appears in a book that states that the astronauts were brainwashed to forget what they saw on the moon. Do you think that this ties in any way with like alien abductions where people claim to have been brainwashed?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think, you know, we wonder whether guys have been brainwashed or helped to forget, because a lot of them seem to, they tell stories of not really remembering what their experience was like on the moon and not really being able to remember anything except, you know, if you ask them what do they do on the moon, they can recite you chapter and verse, you know, what they did, how they went here. They follow, in other words, the script they were given, a task that they had to accomplish, they can remember all that. But when you ask them what did it feel like, what did it look like, you get these very vague answers. And I even recently saw there was a documentary on the moon. I forget the exact title of it, but it was real recent, back in December, I think it was. And they had interviews with Buzz Aldrin and some of the astronauts that went to the moon. And again, they give these extremely vague descriptions of what it was like. Oh, it was magnificent. It was desolate. It was, you know, but it's not really very specific. So.
Right.
So we thought that maybe, you know, and we were told by somebody who did work for NASA that all the astronauts, as part of their debriefing, were hypnotized in order to help them remember, quote, end quote, help them remember details. Now, if that's true, and I don't know that it's true, we did report it, but we reported that as anecdotal evidence. If that's true, then I think, you know, it's possible that there was some suggestions implanted in their subconscious to try to make it difficult for them to remember some of the things that maybe they really didn't, NASA didn't want them to be talking about. But I don't think it's associated with the abduction phenomenon at all.
The book seems to indicate that there were glass domes under glass domes, and then there was glass domes over those glass domes, and each one was a larger size, of course. And I'm not sure, does this mean that you feel that maybe ultimately, there was like one huge glass dome over everything?
Well, yeah, there could have been a lot of glass structure all over the moon. I think, you know, what we are saying now, what we will officially say, I guess, at this point, because Richard talked about it yesterday in his presentation, is that the dark parts of the moon, the maria, as they're called, represent the areas where this battered glass dome structures still exist on the moon today. So that is an awful lot of the real estate. If you look at the moon, the dark areas are an awful lot of the real estate. But I think over millions and maybe even billions of years, a lot of this structure, a lot of this ancient technology has been eroded away by meteorite impacts.
Mm-hmm.
So, it makes a certain amount of sense that you would have layers and different types of protection of glass domes if you were building it to protect a civilization from the environment of space, the hard vacuum.
Mm. The government and NASA in particular is looking more and more foolish as more evidence about the objects on the moon and Mars leak out. What do you think they haven't brought in another agency like the FBI to try and stop these leaks?
I think that, and again, this has to go back to sort of the religious aspect of it, but I think that what we're seeing is that they are obligated to release the information if, A, we ask for it, and, B, I think in a very measured way that will not cause panic. So I think what they're really doing is just sort of, it's that time to release aspirin. That's Richard's favorite analogy, is time to release aspirin. You just let a little bit here and a little bit there. And I think, to me, their behavior is consistent in the fact that they're following a pattern that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. So, do you think that any alien technology has been brought back from the moon?
You know, until I saw the robot head, Data's head, as we like to call it, I didn't think so, but now I'm not so sure. Clearly, there are, as we look at more photographs of the lunar surface that were taken by the astronauts, there is stuff, junk, technology, ruins all around them at different times, especially on Apollo 17. That seems to be a real salvage mission. So, yeah, I think they brought some of that stuff back. They were certainly equipped to be able to do so. Nothing really big, but they could have brought back a lot of little things. And it's kind of like, you know, kind of like Terminator 2 or something. you know, you don't need that much advanced alien technology to really make use of it. You wouldn't need a whole lot. you just need something that inspires you to think in certain directions you wouldn't have thought of before.
Do you think we have a secret space program and that we're making regular landings on the moon and maybe Mars?
Well, that's an interesting question again. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think if we're going to do a sequel to Dark Mission, which you're talking about, it's going to be called the Secret Space Program. I believe there's a lot more evidence now coming out, some stuff I can't really talk about yet that we're digging into, that implies that maybe there was very, very advanced technology available. Even at the same time we were doing the rocket missions to the moon, there may have been a secret program that maybe the NASA guys didn't even know about that that is utilizing much more advanced technology.
I've been a proponent of that for many years.
Well, I think you're ahead of the curve, Ken, because we're catching up to you now, and we're now starting to dig into some stuff. And again, I don't want to quite talk about it yet because there's some things.
No, save it for the next interview.
yeah, I'll try to do that. Yeah, hopefully we can. Yeah.
At this point, Mike, I'd like to give you an opportunity to say whatever you would like.
Well, I just would like to say to anybody out there that's listening that or reading that give our book a chance, give it a read. What we try to lay out, and what I really want to do is, I don't think you have to believe everything that we believe or accept every conclusion that we've come to in Dark Mission. But what I think you'll get if you read the book is you really will not be able to say to yourself, gosh, there's absolutely nothing to this. You know, what I hope is that you will go through the book and you will come away suspicious and a lot more questioning of the things that NASA especially tells you. So that would be my message to people out there, which is just, stay on top of them and don't let them get away with stuff when they lie.
Well, that was a very interesting interview, and I really enjoyed it, Mike, I must tell you.